take a deep breath, take the higher road. That's what they always say, as if they know the way. They won't take it from me. But don't ever doubt yourself, it's life ain't just a dream. You make your own, so kick and scream. The people move alike with a never-ending force. You never had the chance, so what you waiting for? The day has come, my friend, cause this is war.
Hello, everyone. I am so excited for this next guest. I have just been connecting with so many brave people recently. And you know how I feel about my journey and my path on here, from being a bedside nurse to a radio host, is that God is using me and my story to promote the truth. And I did a post on Facebook and I had a comment by my guest, who I will be introducing here shortly, who said, I'm a whistleblower in Hawaii. And I said, oh my goodness, let's reach out. So her and I had a conversation on the phone and, talked for over an hour, and every single thing she was saying, I related to all of it, every single bit of it. And I found out that she has a book. It's called Pandemic in Paradise. You can go to smithvirologist.com and check out her book. It's available wherever books are sold. And she also has a Substack that you can connect through there as well. So it's smithvirologist.com. This Pandemic in Paradise is an insider's view of COVID corruption in Hawaii. She's a virologist with subject matter expertise in respiratory viruses and served on the front lines of the pandemic response in Hawaii. Dr. Jennifer Smith is uniquely positioned to comment on and address the public health response to the SARS-CoV-2 pandemic. So about the book, I'm just going to briefly read this. In late 2019, the world was rocked by the emergence of a novel coronavirus. Within months, this deadly virus had spread across the globe, quickly gaining pandemic status. But when COVID-19 began ravaging Hawaii, the state failed to respond effectively to protect its residents. As the number of cases began to skyrocket, the few epidemiological specialists tasked with investigation and contact tracing quickly became overwhelmed. Meanwhile, leadership at the Hawaii Department of Health falsely reported to the media and general public that staffing was adequate. Pandemic in Paradise is the historic account of the COVID-19 response in Hawaii, a response that will go down alongside the burning of Chinatown in 1900. Is one of the worst civic disasters in state history. In its pages, Dr. Jennifer Smith, trained virologist and former epidemiological specialist at the Hawaii Department of Health, recounts the failed response efforts and corruption of state leadership she witnessed as a frontline worker during the pandemic. With unflinching honesty, Jennifer reveals how her determination to blow the whistle on that failure and corruption led to her dismissal without cause. Science, politics, lies, and one shining light of truth. This story has it all, and you will not be able to put it down. Now, I will say I have not read it, but having spoken with Dr. Jennifer Smith, like I said, everything she said resonated with me, and I am very proud and honored to have another courageous person speaking the truth and coming forward on this show. And so thank you so much, Dr. Jennifer Smith, for joining me on Nurses Out Loud. I am your host, Nurse Jody O'Malley, and let's get started by telling our listeners a little bit about your background.
Yes, thank you, Jody. Appreciate you having me on and giving me an opportunity to share my story. So I like to tell people I'm a third degree microbiologist. So I have a PhD in microbiology and molecular cell sciences with subject matter expertise in respiratory viruses. I've spent a majority of my career working with influenza mainly, but also other respiratory viruses like RSV and mumps. I've spent over 12 years working in vaccine development and preclinical testing. I manage government contract to test candidate vaccines for Ebola virus. And then most recently, as you stated, I worked as an epidemiologist at the Hawaii Department of Health and was on the front lines of the pandemic response there, doing case investigation and contact tracing.
Yes, let's talk about that. Let's go back. Well, we can go back as far as you want. But essentially, what I remember of our conversation was talking about, SARS or COVID coming out and what everybody's response was. You and I agreed on a lot of it. So let's just start there.
Okay, so in terms of in Hawaii, our response actually started very early because we are a jumping off point from Asia to the United States, and so we have a connection to Southeast Asia, and a lot of the population there is linked to China and Japan and that region. So we began immediately with following or you know. Quarantining travelers coming from Southeast Asia. And so we were responsible for well checks and quarantine of those people. So we had to, you know, follow those people for 14 days. We quickly found out this wasn't really a good way for case finding. So a lot of those people, you know, in Asia, they're very used to the efforts there, wearing masks and staying at home and all of that. So they were very compliant. We had very little issues. None of those people ever turned up sick. We then got our first actually confirmed case March 6th of 2020. So we're actually 4 years. This is a 4 year anniversary of the pandemic declaration of the pandemic as
Yeah.
March 11th. So we're 2 days out of the 4 year anniversary. So cases started coming, confirmed cases started coming with initiation of the testing. So what I found interesting right off the bat was the way they were doing the testing. And I knew immediately that there was an issue. So I've done PCR, performed, developed, performed PCR hundreds of times. I could do it with my eyes closed, my one arm tied behind my back. And so when I heard how they were doing the testing, I immediately red flag went up and I was like, no, wait, they're doing it wrong. This is going to be a problem. A lot of people are going to be testing positive when they're not really. And, you know, seeing the epidemiological data along with the test results was very telling because, you know, a lot of people didn't have symptoms. And I'm like, well, if you don't have symptoms, then you don't have COVID. So testing positive, you know, detecting some bit of genetic material does not mean you have COVID. You know, it's akin to having HIV positive, but not having AIDS. So it was very intriguing to me, having studied respiratory viruses my entire career. It was like, how do you think a respiratory virus spreads if you don't have any symptoms? Like, there's no such thing as an asymptom spreader of a respiratory virus. So,
Okay, so
you know.
that right there, for me as well, not even having the background that you did, I immediately thought, oh my God. Okay, so there's some virus that's out there that people are spreading, but they have no symptoms of being sick and infected with said virus.
Correct. So I'm like, the way the testing was done, you're going to have a lot of false positives. So I thought, you know, I talked myself out of it. I was like, well, you know, in a public health From a public health perspective, I could see how you would err on the side of caution and you would want more false positives than false negatives if this is indeed a highly deadly, scary virus. So I kind of talked myself out of it. But as I got into case investigation and was talking to people, because I had to call all the people and then call their contacts and follow all of them. And, you know, it was starting to sink in that something wasn't right here. Something definitely was very wrong. The response was not proportionate to the threat. It wasn't making any sense to me. So I immediately called this out, like the whole PCR testing. I called this out to leadership. And I recall at one point they actually took some cases off the case count, only to add them on later on, like months later.
Yeah. So let's talk about that. Tell us what PCR is, how it's used, and how they were using it at this time.
Right, so PCR is a very powerful tool. So it can detect very minute amounts of genetic material in a specimen. Now, the issue is PCR is not meant to be used standalone. So, as a diagnostic test, you want to use PCR in collaboration or in conjunction with clinical symptoms. So, you never want to say, based on the PCR alone, you cannot determine whether or not somebody actually is sick. So it cannot detect or tell you whether or not a virus is actually viable, meaning it's actively replicating. So a lot of times you're detecting just bits of material. But again, it doesn't tell you anything about the status of the infection, where they are in the infection cycle, whether they're contagious or infectious.
Tell people, what does that mean, clinical symptoms? What does that mean?
So clinical symptoms, fever, cough, headache,
Okay.
body aches,
Yep.
you know, if somebody's coughing or sneezing, runny nose, sore throat. So for influenza, we use a case definition for influenza. So the first thing we do as an epidemiologist, I'll take a step back. First thing we do when we have an outbreak of a disease is we set a case definition. What does that mean? We decide what we're going to include or who we're going to include as a case. Usually, again, this includes clinical symptoms and a confirmatory diagnostic laboratory test. So for influenza, it's generally fever, which is 100.4 or higher, and cough and or sore throat. So you have to have fever and one of the other two at least, plus a confirmatory laboratory test, which would be PCR. Or culture. So you would have to culture the virus, meaning grow it up in a laboratory. But you would have to have those two things. So it was very intriguing to me that I told my coworkers, you know, we finally get a case definition for this, what is COVID? I said, a lot of these will probably go away because there are no clinical symptoms. They're not going to count as a case. Well, I was wrong.
Because then they
When the
said
case,
asymptomatic, right?
right. So I think the word we want there is healthy,
Exactly.
which always made me laugh. I was like, we can say subclinical. We used to say subclinical infection, you know, as a nurse, you know, it's subclinical infection. Now we're all of a sudden like people who are perfectly healthy or supposedly sick. It didn't make any sense. It's just
Right.
nonsensical. So, of course, the CST, which is the Council for State and Territory Epidemiologists, came out with a definition, I believe, in April of 2020, and it was solely based on a positive test, a positive PCR test. The other interesting part of that case definition was that for those who died, they didn't even have to test positive. So, if there was COVID listed anywhere on the death certificate, then they were counted as a COVID case and a COVID death.
Because at
So,
that time, they also allowed clinicians to presume positive based off of clinical symptoms of, say, a runny nose. Remember, we had to go through all of these things. Do you have a cough, fever, sore throat, diarrhea, abdominal pain, muscle aches? I mean, every single symptom that a person can possibly have was listed. Guys,
Right. Everything became COVID, a
everything.
rash, a fever, you know, a stub toe. Literally everything became COVID. And I was like, you know, we're muddying the waters to the point where I don't even know what COVID really is. Like, There's no define. I don't know how clinicians were doing it because there was nothing that really defined it. For me, I started to hear about the loss of smell and taste. And for me, that became very, became for me the key symptom was like, oh, okay, that to me tells me, yes, this is most likely COVID. Although we do see it in other respiratory, with other respiratory viruses as well, but it became very clear that that was a defining feature.
What other respiratory viruses would we get loss of taste and smell with?
There are over 100 viruses that cause respiratory illness in humans.
Okay.
So
All right.
yeah, I mean, it just happens. And some people, you know, depending on the length and severity of disease, it can happen with anything. It can happen with rhinovirus, it could happen with flu. You know, there's, like I said, over 100 viruses that can cause respiratory illness in
Okay.
people.
So
And
note that, guys.
generally, I would like to say we don't test for those. You know, you go to the doctor. I don't feel good, cough, sore throat, runny nose. Generally, doctors don't test for anything. The only thing we usually test for on a routine basis is influenza. So why do we test for influenza? From an epidemiological standpoint, we use influenza for surveillance. So it's kind of a measure of the burden of respiratory disease that's out in the community. So we wouldn't test for any other viruses, adenovirus, RSV, HMPV, any of those, unless flu negative. Sometimes for surveillance, we will take a random sampling of negative flu samples and test for other respiratory viruses just to give us an idea of what may be floating around out there. So
Okay.
this whole idea of like test, 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 it became a testing pandemic. We initially were asking clinicians throughout flu and all other respiratory pathogens prior to being able to test for SARS. When testing became largely available in the clinical laboratories, they stopped testing for flu altogether and only tested for SARS. Everything was only SARS. So in Hawaii, we have a year-round flu season. It was very interesting to me because as the influenza coordinator, we were heading for a huge flu epidemic. We went from 20, over 20% of all those tested for flu were testing positive at the end of 2019. By early March of 2020, 40% of all those being tested were testing positive for flu. That's, I mean, that's unheard of. You know, in a season, it may be like in the teens, you know, 11, 12%. So 40% was astronomical. And then SARS testing became widely available. Flu, 0%. 0%.
0%. Now remember that, guys, because that's really important. Almost half of the people that came to the doctor, right, prior to March of 2020 that had symptoms were testing positive for flu. Now, for flu, we would treat the symptoms, right? We would manage their symptoms. We would give them, something to open up their airways, right? A steroid, a nebulizer. We would treat them with a
Tamiflu.
Tamiflu, right? Tamiflu, which when found early, is effective at lowering their illness by a day or two. Okay. And in some people that have a low immune system or are elderly, that day or two could be life or death, right? So in those populations, treating them early with an antiviral is very, very important. Also, too, when somebody has symptoms for an extended period of time, they would give an antibiotic to prevent a secondary infection that, because their body is being overwhelmed, their immune system is fighting so hard that maybe it crashes out and allows a pneumonia to set in. So we would give an antibiotic. What I'm hearing right now is we stopped caring about all of that.
So from where I was sitting, we fielded phone calls from laboratory staff, from the general public, from clinicians. I had clinicians calling me like, what do we do? What do we do? I'm like, be a doctor. What do you normally do when you have a patient with fever and a cough? Do that. do that. Like early on, they were giving, you know, a budesonide, inhalers, azithromycin, some steroids. So early on, those people were getting treatment. They were doing just fine. They were recovering just fine at home. So somewhere along the way, doctors forgot all of their training.
Yep. Yep.
And unfortunately, we had people, you know, we had people spectrum, people who tested positive, thought they had to be in the hospital. I'm positive. I need to be in the hospital, but you don't have symptoms. So just stay home. You're okay. Like we had people who would stay home until they turned blue and then call the ambulance. Like we couldn't, like that's
that was it.
That's what I'm not a clinician. I can't tell you. I can't tell you what treatment, but you know, if you're having trouble breathing, call the ambulance. I mean, this, when, Jody, you know, yep. Pneumonia is very serious. When in the world do you ever not do something when somebody is developing respiratory problems and pneumonia? Pneumonia is very serious. You hit it with everything in the kitchen sink.
Yep. That's exactly what you do, you know, especially for those people that, you know, immune system are taxed and, you know, are struggling at that point. You're exactly right. What we told everybody, stay home. There's no treatment for COVID. Just stay home until this vaccine it comes out and then you can move about freely. And if you have to go out into the world, you know, to get fresh air, like in the state of Hawaii, remember, that's like the best place to be. You've got the salt water, the ocean, right? Yeah. The wind that is constantly moving, the breezes. I mean, salt, saline is so good for our respiratory tract, and they close down the beaches. You know, before we continue to talk about that, let's talk a little bit about the PCR test and let's compare. The PCR test is used for testing of the flu, right? When they swab the nose. And how is that different from the COVID test?
I mean, it's the same principle. It's the same platform. You know, you just use, it's very specific and very sensitive. So it's very specific for each thing you're looking for. But it's the same, it's exactly the same principle.
But same principle, but we, you know, let's talk about cycle thresholds.
Okay. I didn't know if you wanted
me to go. It's very technical. I want to get into that because that's what I was telling everybody. I said, we are admitting people that are healthy here. They are healthy, right? They don't have any symptoms. What they were doing, Dr. Smith, was people were coming in anxious, right?
Yes.
Now they're waiting to come to the ER because they weren't coming before. Now they're super anxious. We're testing their oxygen level with a mask on. Okay. We told their family to wait outside because they can't come in anymore.
Yep.
So now you have the person kind of panicked because they don't have their advocate next to them. They're getting tested with their mask on, which was lowering their oxygen level in many cases, right? And then we would admit them. Now, since their oxygen level was low at triage, that prompted them to be put on 2 liters of oxygen, okay? Then when that test came back that they were positive, the hospitalist would admit them because if they required oxygen, then they were a candidate to receive the experimental remdesivir. You know how many people I got discharged because I knocked on their door, their window, right? That was clear. And I told them, I, you know, signaled to them with my hand, take off your cannula. And I would sit there and watch them and watch their oxygen stay normal. And then I would have to call the hospitalist and say, they are not a candidate for admission. They don't meet the requirements. And the doctor would always say, well, it's documented in their chart that their oxygen was 91% or 90, you know, 90%, 88%, whatever it was. And I said, yes, but we tested them when they were anxious, when we removed the advocate and when they had a mask on, doc. So go down there and look at them again. And then they would look at them and they'd be 96, 98%, 100%, and he would discharge them. So that's what I'm saying. Like, and I would go to the lab and I'm asking them, once I learned about PCR testing, I would say, what's our cycle threshold at?
Yes.
And nobody knew.
Well, that was disturbing to me. I became a point of contact consulting for all the clinical laboratories because clinical laboratory staff didn't even know what PCR was. So in the clinical lab, you basically drop the sample in a cartridge, stick in a machine, hit start, spits out a result, and that's what they go with. So they have no idea the principles and the behind this technology. And so, I'm having to explain to them, do you know what PCR is? Do you know how it works? Do you know the principles? Do you know, and one laboratory actually called them, results were coming out. And I actually called and said, I think your machine is not calibrated properly. I wasn't even in the lab. And I knew, I was like, this has been reported from other states. You might want to call the manufacturer and get your, they stopped talking to me because they started collecting CT values, and educating my coworkers, hey, like you have somebody with no symptoms, get the CT values. A lot of these tests were coming back what's called presumptive positive. So it wasn't even confirmed positive. Mm-hmm. Now, I will also tell you, CDC has actually published their F up. I don't know if I can say the word, but I believe in December of 2021, the CDC did a qualitative analysis of their initial PCR test kit. And lo and behold, everything that I said was exactly true. Not only were the primers sticking to themselves, so what happens is you have these little bits of DNA that are supposed to stick to some genetic material in the sample. They have a little beacon on the end. And when they stick, the beacon lights up and the laser beam detects it. So then they were sticking to each other, giving off a signal, meaning the test kit itself was giving a positive signal. The second most important thing that they published was that the test kits, they basically spiked the punch. The test kits were contaminated with viral genetic material.
Oh my gosh, that's what everybody was saying.
So that's why all these like swabs that never touched a nose, water, orange juice, all these animals were coming up positive because the test itself, you could have just run the test kits. And, I had colleagues at CDC and they told me they were very upset with the lack of quality control. So what this did was this artificially inflated case counts early on. And that's what was used to push all this public health policy and draconian measures.
That's exactly it. That's exactly it. They put the mask on, right? They first told everybody to wear a mask to promote
fear. No, they first told everyone not to wear a mask.
Right.
They said, no, right. Masks don't do anything. And I already knew that having worked in I managed a biocontainment safety lab. I did respiratory protection, wore a respirator, wore a purified air powered respirator. I did this fit testing for people. So the first told us not to wear them.
Uh-huh. Okay. You know what? Since we're on the mask, let's talk about the mask because that was the thorn in my side. When with Fauci and what's his name, the Surgeon General came out and said, don't wear a mask. Masks do nothing to protect you from SARS-CoV-2. We're not going to be a nation of mask wearers because they do nothing. And then a couple weeks later, now it's like, wear a mask. Something happened.
They said, wear something to cover your face. It wasn't even, it could be a t-shirt. It could be, let me tell you, as a virologist, I just laughed. I was like, I had a paper sitting on my desk prior to this where they did a study on surgical masks versus N95 respirators in terms of influenza infection in healthcare workers. And what they found was there was no difference. What does that mean? That means the same number of people who wore surgical mask got influenza as the same number as the people who wore an N95 respirator. So it was like the same number of people in both groups got flu. So it did not. So look, the virus is really submicroscopic, the particle size. I did bioaerosol studies. That's what a lot of my time was spent. I aerosolize virus. I aerosolize for different amounts of times, different droplet size, different you know, titers of virus. I looked at all of this. This is my area of expertise. So I can tell you, like, it just made me laugh. I was like, not only that, and this came up too, is when we do animal studies for respiratory viruses, we don't just drip them in their nose, we drip them in their eye. The eye is a very key portal of entry because you know the olfactory bulb is right there. The virus is going to go right in. So, you know, you want to cover your face. It has to be very tightly sealed. You have to get tested for a respirator, but you also have to cover your eyes and seal your eyes.
Yeah. Well, I'm quickly realizing that this interview is going to be a two-part show. So I'm just throwing that out there right now because we need to dive in to the actual science of all of this for you guys to understand why Dr. Smith risked life and career to come forward, and other whistleblowers have done the same. So guys, we're talking about masks. We're talking about aerosolized respiratory viruses. Go to AmericaOutloud.shop. And check out our family of sponsors for oral nasal hygiene therapies. You, as a listener, receive an exclusive discount to these products. So we have X-Clear, we have Cofix RX. Go check those out and actually do something that is going to help you and not harm you or make you feel like you're actually protecting yourself by wearing a mask. And we will be right back after the break.
It's time and this is war.
You wouldn't go a day without brushing your teeth or washing your hands. What about washing your nose? I mean, your nose does filter the air you breathe, air loaded with bacteria, viruses, and irritants. Make nasal hygiene part of your routine with Clear. No messy bottles to fill, no drowning sensation. Clear is a natural drug-free saline with the added benefit of xylitol, which blocks bacterial and viral adhesion. Available in stores and online at clear.com. That is X-L-E-A-R.com.
Cholesterol, blood pressure, blood sugar, inflammation, and weight. These are all real-world problems that 87% of Americans are struggling with. Often, there are no symptoms. But left unattended, we become inundated with one health problem after another. It's time to fight back with HealRight. HealRight is a bar that you eat, but it's food as medicine that addresses the nutritional root cause of health issues in just 8 weeks. Developed by world-renowned scientists and backed by 15 years of research, HealRight is effective, but it's also delicious and works without additional diet or lifestyle changes. Step out of the statistics and use food as medicine. Visit healright.com/outloud or AmericaOutloud.shop and use the code OUTLOUD for 20% off.
Clean, pure, with premium ingredients, Global Healing's Pure Plant Protein offers 20 grams of protein per scoop, and it's a perfect way to maintain and build lean muscle while indulging yourself. It combines enzymes and probiotics to maximize nutrient absorption, improving digestion, and your gut health. Available in vanilla and chocolate flavors, elevate your protein consumption while supporting your overall wellness with Pure Plant Protein. Go to AmericaOutloud.shop and get 15% off using the code OUTLOUD. Global Healing, giving you the power to take control of your health naturally.
Don't accept joint aches and stiffness as part of aging. Doctors at Advanced Nutrition Company, Healthy Cell, created Joint Health and Mobility to support connective tissue, joint lubrication, and reduce joint irritation with curcumin, omega-3, chondroitin, glucosamine, and hyaluronic acid for joint comfort and flexibility. And Healthy Cell's not a pill. It's a gel you swallow. Get 100% drug-free joint support. Go to HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for 25% off your first order. That's HealthyCell.com. Code out loud.
Expert opinions, honest debate, and in-depth investigations are what you've come to expect from AmericaOutloud.news. We don't shy away from speaking the truth boldly and plainly. All that's missing is the propaganda that has infected legacy and social media. Get the best of down and dirty, wholesome American speak. Now Now is our time, my fellow Americans. America Out Loud Talk Radio. Liberty and justice for all.
Welcome back. Thank you so much for joining me on this episode of Nurses Out Loud. I am your host, Nurse Jody O'Malley. And 5 days a week, guys, you can hear my amazing sister nurses that are speaking truth and doing the same thing that I'm doing on here, sharing stories of courage and bravery and facts and science to keep you better informed. Make sure that you are liking, reviewing, saving, sharing our show, because whatever platform you're on listening to us, the algorithms boost us up in the feed so more people can hear it, hear the truth, right? And develop their own opinion. It's about being informed and educating yourself so that this never, ever happens again, that you do not react out of fear, that you are reacting out of being informed and in having your own bodily autonomy. And as always, send us an email, nurses@americaoutloud.com. We want to hear from you and share your story as well. Okay, Dr. Smith. So we're talking about masks now, but then I really want to go back to PCR testing, because those two things to me were what drove this entire thing. You know, the putting a mask on to fear people, you know, allowing experimental emergency use authorized test to promote the case count, giving doctors the ability to say with one or two symptoms during freaking allergy season that you are presumed positive. Right. And then if you were presumed positive and you were having symptoms, now you are in the hospital using another experimental medication, remdesivir. We're going to get into all of this. But OK, we're on masks. Talk to me about your expertise in masks. And also, too, I remember them saying this is a droplet precaution. Masks work on a droplet. But we knew based on coronaviruses that it was aerosolized. But they didn't come out and admit that until months or maybe even a year later. So just talk, let's just talk about masks and your expertise in this department.
Right. So for me, there's only two groups of people who should have worn masks. Number one would have been those who are sick, with the caveat being then just stay home. So don't go out in public. And then surgeons who are performing surgery. So the thing is, you know, those, if they're not tightly fit on your face, coughing and sneezing, you know, that we did, like I said, when I did bioaerosol studies, we did aerosol tests, and you could see leakage around a surgical mask does absolutely nothing. Those droplets are coming out all sides, top, bottom, everywhere. So, you know, plus if you don't have symptoms, if you're not coughing and you're not sneezing, then what is the concern? There's no way, if you don't have symptoms, you clearly are not. Even if you are subclinically infected, you're clearly not have enough virus in there to make yourself sick. You're not going to have enough to transmit to another person. So the question I kept asking, something we use in virology called infectious dose. What is the infectious dose? There are some viruses like norovirus, which is the number one virus that causes gastrointestinal illness. You've probably heard cruise ships all the time, norovirus outbreak. One virus particle can make a person sick. I mean, it takes very, very little to make a lot of people sick. What is the infectious dose for SARS? We don't know. How do we not know? Give me a lab in a week and I'll tell you. You know, it's not a difficult thing to figure out. So in my professional opinion, if you don't have symptoms, if you're not coughing, sneezing, have fever, there's not enough virus inside of you to be able to transmit to another person and make anyone sick. And that's why children were never a threat. Children were not a threat because Their innate immune system is so strong that even if they did get infected, it would knock the virus down. And even if they had virus in them, it was never enough to shed or spread to another person.
Okay. Yeah. I also remember hearing something about their ACE2 receptor not being developed, and the
Oh, yeah, that's.
SARS-CoV-2 attaches to the ACE2 receptor. Is what are your thoughts on that?
I mean, there's variable expression of ACE2 depending on gender, depending on age, depending. Yes. So it's very highly variable in terms of the ACE2. I mean, that's a whole huge rabbit hole
Okay.
on.
Okay. So
So
we won't go there. We don't have time to unpack that.
right.
But I remember in the beginning, I want to even say it was in the fall of 2020 when the CDC came out and said what the people that were at high risk and low risk. So nurses were at high risk when they were caring directly caring face to face, like putting in an IV, putting on a blood pressure monitor, cleaning up a patient, those types of things, that they were at low risk of becoming infected if they were at the bedside with no mask on, okay? No mask, putting in an IV, being in the patient's bedside with them coughing, sneezing, doing whatever they're doing because they're symptomatic for less than 15 minutes. If I hit 15 minutes and 1 second, now I'm at high risk.
You know, that's the thing that made me laugh too, is like, you know, there's so many variables that come into play when you're talking about transmission of a respiratory virus, right? So there's three, and I like to categorize them into three classes. Now, one would be the person. So what is the health status of the person? You know, age, underlying medical conditions. Then you would talk about the virus itself. Like I said, what is the infectious dose? What is the replication cycle? Those features. And then most importantly are the environmental factors. So something that I spent a lot of time on, looking at the environmental factors involved in transmission. pH, temperature, relative humidity is huge. Relative humidity. Now we know the fastest and easiest way, and the thing that no one ever talked about was ventilation. The fastest and easiest way to disperse all these droplets was open a window. It was,
Girl.
and you know, here in Hawaii, or in Hawaii, I should say, we had the best situation because most places didn't have air conditioning. Doors and windows, my house, doors and windows open all the time.
Yeah.
We had jalous windows, the best ventilation, tropical breezes. There's nothing that's going to just hang in the air. And this is why, this is what I said, this is why we have influenza outbreaks in the winter. People congregate inside, doors and windows are shut. So that's why the virus spreads. When does the epidemic end? In the springtime. Weather warms up, people open their doors and windows and they go outside. Boom, flu epidemic gone.
Yeah.
This is the best case scenario was Hawaii.
It was the most amazing place to be during the pandemic, would be in Hawaii.
Weather-wise, yes.
Weather-wise, not politic-wise, but weather-wise, that was another so when I was researching all this very early on, and they tried to put masks on and close down the kids' school, and we could talk a little bit about that as well, but I thought, who are the experts in masks? What are they called? What is their name? Who are those people that fit tested us? And I found it was industrial hygienists. It's
Occupational health.
occupational health and safety. And those are the Tammy Clark and Kristen Megan. I found them on Facebook. And so I was following them, just soaking up everything. And then, I found out about their colleague who is the highest credentialed out there, Stephen Petty. And I found his YouTube channel, and he was talking about the little guys and the big guys, and then talking about the hierarchy of control for respiratory viruses. And right there at the top would be like destruction. Is there a way that we can destroy this? Well, no, not right now, right? I mean, there's stuff that you could put in your ventilation, but they never even went down that rabbit hole. But then it was circulation, ventilation, that we were telling people to stay home. With my group of people was the Native Americans who live, you know, in rural areas. Like more than 80% of this population lives on the reservation with no running water, no electricity. And we were locking them in multi-generational households saying to stay together. And it's like, oh my gosh, what did we do?
Right.
What did we do?
This was the problem in Hawaii. You know, in Hawaii, very expensive. You have a 300 square foot condo, no air conditioning, might be five people living there. So all we did was move transmission from public spaces into private homes. So, you know, you're a nurse, you know, if the kid gets sick, most likely everybody else in the family going to get sick. The mom gets sick, everybody else is going to get sick. That's how it happens. It just spreads through the family. You know, that's just natural.
Yeah.
We live together. We congregate together. We spend a lot of time together. We're going to get so, you know, it was ridiculous to me. I felt so bad for these people sitting in their little tiny condos, you know, trapped. We had congregate living is very huge in Hawaii. Multi-generational homes, as you said, is very huge because of the cost of living. So you have, you know, grandparents, parents, and children all living in the same house together. Okay, well, high-risk people, you know, and it wasn't the children. This is what disturbed me. It wasn't the children. It was the people we needed to be worried about were the working people, the people in their, you know, late teens, 40s, 50s. Those were the people going out to work. Those were the people interacting in the public. Then they were bringing it back home to their elderly family members. Mm-hmm. So those were the people that we needed to be concerned about separating from the elderly. And keeping the elderly, as I like to say, protect our VIPs, our vulnerable, important persons. So those were the people that we needed to really protect. It wasn't the kids being able to hug grandma and grandpa. It was those working, going outside the home.
Yep. And then that's what we would see here, you know, at my hospital, Phoenix Indian Medical Center, which is about 3 hours or so from the reservation. Most of the people in the hospital are Native Americans, and a lot of them have family up on the res. And they would do their shifts. And then on the weekends, they would go home and see their family. Now, that's not that big of a deal for them to be able to do that because, you know, we knew like there's things that we can do to boost our immunity, you know,
well, be outside.
But they wouldn't even allow funerals and burials and all of these things that are really important to the culture of their people to do that. And we could have told them, put a fan on in the room. Open up a window when you guys are together. Like, you know what I'm saying? There's things that we could have done that we did not do. Very, very, very basic things that we could have done. So thank you for bringing up. I didn't even know we were going to talk about that, but that's great. Yeah.
I mean, that was the problem, you know, in Hawaii was just a joke. They shut all public beaches, all public parks, all hiking trails. Was the best place to be was outside. Outside.
Yeah. Yeah.
In the sun, you know, there's plenty of space. You know, this 6-foot bubble cracked me up too. I was like, where did this even come from? Like, what is, like, again, all the environmental factors that come into play in transmission. I'm like, there's nothing magical that happens at 6 feet. You know, it was just some number they pulled out of their, you know what?
Yeah.
And said, okay, at this distance, you're good. And I'm like, well, this doesn't make.
Yeah. And then think about how much money businesses put into putting circles down, putting plexiglass up. Like, think of how much money was spent. It was a whole nother industry.
You know, and let me tell you, that plexiglass was the worst thing ever because what did it do? Disrupted the airflow. So then you have disruption of airflow, which actually causes these particles to go bonkers and actually more easily transmit to people. So here we are in Hawaii banning plastic bags and plastic straws, and then they put plexiglass everywhere. I mean, I literally went to the post office and they had shower curtains hanging up in between. I'm like, your door's open. It's an open facility. Everything there is open. You know, it was like, what?
Right. What are you?
So all these barriers did was actually made it worse because it just disrupted airflow and ventilation.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. Yes. So we agree that masks did nothing, right?
Well, I mean, if it gave somebody the, it's like a placebo effect. If it made somebody feel more comfortable, look, if you want to wear one, you know, it doesn't hurt me. You want to wear it. If it makes you feel more comfortable, then that's fine. You know, so if it made somebody feel more comfortable, more at ease, then maybe it did help.
Okay. Something. So you make a good point. What we did by instituting the mask and the circles and the shutdowns and the lockdowns was institute fear. By allowing the numbers to rise with the experimental PCR test, which, by the way, is still experimental, okay? No, it's still not FDA approved. Matter of fact, whatever, we won't get there. But it doesn't still tell us anything, let's say that, for the most part, right? Unless you have the symptoms along
well,
with
what it said, as I said, it should be used in conjunction with the clinical symptoms. And it doesn't tell you whether you're contagious or infectious. So if you have no symptoms, even being positive doesn't mean you're contagious or infectious.
Okay, perfect. Thank you. That's good. So what we did was institute mass amounts of fear. And then what that does, guys, is increases your stress level. Your adrenal glands kick in. Your whole body is like in a fight or flight kind of stage. And that makes you susceptible for illness. Okay. So I think what I'm hearing Dr. Smith say is, okay, if you wanted to wear a mask and that made you more at ease and less anxious, then that was a benefit. Yeah, right.
I mean, you know, I saw people walking. I would walk through the park to work and they're wearing a mask and gloves and a face shield. And I just joked. I was like, do they think they're dropping this from the planes as they fly overhead? I mean, where do you think this is coming from? People driving alone in a car. I'm like, are you infecting yourself? Like, I don't understand the rationale,
right?
You know, and I think now I have a network of people all over the world. And, you know, in India, the children in India should have come to the U.S. and educate people, because the children in India knew what masks were supposed to be for was when you were indoors in crowded spaces.
Mm-hmm.
That's where your risk was increased, indoors, mm-hmm. Not outside at the beach. You know, I went to Hawaii last summer for my hearing, and there's still people. I mean, you think the pandemic's hot on? They're wearing masks all over, still wearing a mask on the beach, still wearing a mask, you know, walking around downtown. I was like, it's ridiculous. They totally, and my coworker said, well, it's easier just to tell people to wear them all the time than to explain the difference. Like, are we that stupid that public health failed at educating people? Are we that stupid that we can't understand the distinction? Children in India got it.
Yeah. Yep. And what we told, and if there was some education, we would have said, do not rewear the disposable mask. Do not rewear it, because now it is contaminated. Once you're out there and you're touching it and you're throwing it into your purse and you're hanging it on your rear view mirror.
For a very highly deadly virus that now, like, these things are all over the place. You know, it's like so highly deadly virus. We're contaminating everything.
We're contaminating
everywhere.
The beaches. We're contaminating the sidewalks, all of those things. I mean, it's just mind blowing. Okay. So I already know that we have a part two coming up. So because we're almost out of time on this one, I just want to reiterate what we kind of spoke about. We spoke about the high cycle thresholds on the PCR testing. We talked about the bunk science made up of circles and how masks could protect you and all of those kinds of things. Let's close this out with what you're trained and your training tells you to handle a pandemic in a certain way. You knew all of these things were happening. What about your colleagues? How come we didn't have more people speaking up and saying, wait a second, this goes against everything that we were ever educated on?
Well, I can sum it up in one word: money. So in research science, at least, all the funding for research comes from the federal government, all of it. So if I have a grant from the NIH, am I going to jeopardize my career and my laboratory and my standing by saying something that goes against the narrative? So number one, in research, in public health, money.
Yep.
All the funding for public health comes from the federal government. 90% of funding for our division was from the federal government.
Yeah. Yeah. And most people that are in your space, because Tammy and Kristen have talked about this, most of the industrial hygienists and OSHA experts are employed by the government.
Yep.
Yep. So there's not very many people that are independent contractors or have in their own businesses. Tammy and Kristen did, Stephen Petty did, you know, Tyson Gabriel. I could go on and on about a couple of other ones. They had their own business and they were like, this is BS. This isn't right. And they tried to get their colleagues to come on board. They agreed with them in private, but they would not speak out in public. And
well, look what happened to people who did. Doctors, yeah, who started pushing against the narrative, you know, scientists, professors, you know, they were all like fired, silenced, censored, as yeah, was I. And so, you know, this is a lot of people were like, oh, they totally agreed, but you know, you go out and you be the one standing out front saying this and we'll hide behind you. So there are a lot
That's
of
right.
I'm gonna say there are a lot of cowards out there who, yeah, would rather hide behind their children or their colleagues instead of standing up and speaking truth.
Yeah, amen. I completely agree with you. Had there been just 100 more of us, right, that were very loud and speaking out and did it very publicly, you know, maybe, I don't know, a few hundred of us, right? This would have stopped. This would have stopped. We would have been able to stop it, but people did not do that. And, you know, guys, you're going to have to stay tuned for part two, right? There was no way that I was going to have someone that is as highly credentialed on here without getting to the basics, right? Because we have to understand the basics of what happened so that when this happens again, it's not if, it's when, you know, that we educate our family, we educate ourselves, we educate our children on what happens and how it was able to be perpetrated. And really, it was a pandemic of courage. Right. Or of cowards. I mean, essentially, people did not want to speak up. And I agree with you. It is because they put their paycheck over people. Yeah. That's it. And so thank you, guys. That's all the time we have for today. Like I said, like, save, review, share. You're going to have part two on next week's episode with Dr. Jennifer Smith, smithvirology.com. Or virologist. I don't have my glasses on.
SmithVirologist.com. I'm yep. also on Substack. Same Smith Virologist on Substack.
Yep. And her book is Pandemic in Paradise. And you can get that wherever books are sold. We are going to touch on her story on part two. So stay tuned. Until next time, be safe, be well, and God bless.
It's time.